Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Treatment-Free Beekeeping Podcast. This episode of the podcast, I am going to be doing another Q&A show, which is a fun chance for everybody to get their questions in and get answers. Maybe if they don't hear the question that they wanted on another show, they can ask and I'll answer it. First questions always will be given to the patrons at patreon.com/TFB and also the members of the TFB pub, which if you are a patron, then you get to be in the pub. That's a closed Facebook group where everybody in there is either patrons or some other way supporters. I have some other supporters who aren't patrons who give their time as moderators. People who help me out with IT stuff and advice on recording and things like that. So that's where those people are. If you'd like to become a patron, go ahead and do that and you can get into that group. So I'm going to start putting all the links and stuff at the end of the show. That way I don't have this big front log of stuff that you have to listen to. When I listen to podcasts, I don't like to have to skip over stuff to get to the good stuff. So in the future, I'm just going to introduce the guest or the subject, and then we're going to move right on to the show. So here goes. Let's get to our first question. If you hear me clicking around in the background, I have all the questions saved on a Google Doc. So I'm going to get over there, get looking into here. I'm working on one screen, so you know I start the recording, then click over to you. Anyway, you don't care. All right, patron questions from the TFB pub. Here we go. Ed English asks, what are your thoughts on feeding newly housed swarms? If at all, how much to feed and for how long? Well, it totally depends on your situation. When I was in Arkansas, swarming took place early enough in the season to where there were still plenty of honey flows, nectar flows going on, so that the swarm, unless it was a late swarm, would have a pretty good chance to be able to get out there and gather some more nectar and build up. This year, here in Oregon, the situation's a bit different. We had a very long, cool, wet spring, winter, and so swarming was a bit delayed, and only the very, very early swarms, the first couple of swarms that I had were able to really build up and get going. The later swarms were not able to, and that's not because it's not necessarily their fault. In a totally natural system, those swarms might die out in the summer, and that sort of genetic winnowing would be passed to the next generation. That swarm that got out on time and was able to do well would survive while the other ones don't. For us, though, because we are beekeepers and not just bee watchers, we might want to help those things along, not because we're trying to coddle them, but because we're trying to get them to survive. And if we're keeping bees and especially trying to get started keeping bees, we want to get a good solid population going first before we introduce those harsher selection techniques. So this year I have been feeding my swarms, not a lot. I put some feeders on there, feed them from time to time, give them a chance to grow up. And for instance, I've got one swarm here on my back porch, and that swarm was able to go. It was my second to last swarm, and it was a very small one, only less than two frames worth of bees. And by feeding them, they are now built up to a full 10-frame nuke, which is going to be gifted to one of my yard hosts. So that's the situation with that one. You really have to be careful, especially in a situation like we have out here with hot and dry conditions, where if you're feeding, you are really risking robbing. So I've gone to not feeding 1-to-1. I feed a 2-to-3 solution. Here's what I do. Let me tell you exactly what I do so that you can get it down, and it's really easy. Get yourself a 5-gallon bucket, multiply as many times as you want, however many buckets you want. And then you're going to take 2 gallons of hot water, just hot tap water. It doesn't have to be boiled or anything. Pour 2 gallons of hot water in there, and then pour 125-pound bag of sugar in there. So that is basically 2 gallons of water and 3 gallons of sugar. So it's a 2-to-3 ratio. And that's all there is to it. You can, it mixes itself pretty well. I give it an extra stir with a paint mixer on the end of a cordless drill gun and go out and dump it in the hive. So it works pretty well. How much to feed and for how long? I would say if you're going to do that, again, only if you need to, don't do anything arbitrarily. If you're going to do that, just get it to this point. Like I have this swarm on the back porch, just get it to where they're filled up with, a deep full of bees and honey, and they'll go into the fall flows and collect what they need. And if with that jump start, they can't get through the winter, then I don't really need them. All right, going to take my headphones off there. They're making my side of my head sweat. I have the air conditioning turned off for sound quality. So, and it's approaching 100 degrees outside, so my head's getting all sweaty. All right, next question from the patrons. Carolyn Jill Sloan asks, how soon can you split a nuke with no queen castle? Is there a tell, like how many frames are drawn out? If you're working, I wouldn't want to split a nuke unless it's a really strong nuke and you're splitting it like 2-to-3. If you've got several nukes, probably the best plan to do would be to take one frame out of each of them, and so you're not creating a bunch of queenless hives. But something as small as a nuke, 5 frames or that size, I wouldn't split anything smaller than a strong 10 frame if I can possibly avoid it. Joshua Jensen asks, I got asked the other day, what do you do if a week after you install your nuke, you find your queen on the ground? I had a few suggestions, but I'm interested in your thoughts. I'm assuming the queen is dead, because if she's out laying on the ground, she's probably dead. I'd probably look in the hive, see if they're working on a new queen cell. If they are, then let them finish up that process and get a new queen. That's what that process is for. Hello. I've got all my notifications turned on. Better turn those off. Wouldn't want to turn that off. There we go. Should be no more noise. If they don't have a queen, maybe it's a possibility that they've got a virgin in there who's maybe booted out the old queen somehow. Wait and see what happens. Always the best thing you can do in queen situations is to add a frame of open brood from another hive once a week until the problem fixes itself. So that'll fix pretty much any queen problem. Where the queen is not still in the hive. If the queen's still in the hive and there's a queen problem, you can pinch her, get rid of her, and still do that. Ed English says, I have another one. Tonight I moved 5 hives to a new apiary. It was midnight when we got done. Should the entrance be unblocked or better left to the morning? I'm going to unblock it. I mean, if we're talking to a whole new apiary, it's going to be a couple miles away from the old location. There's not going to be any worry about bees going back to their old hive location. So unblock it, let them get going with their ventilation. When I move my hives at night, do one of two things. One, a bunch of my hive bottoms and nukes have disc entrances on them, so I just open the disc entrance up. Or if they have something else, I'll usually just take some window screen and staple it over the entrance. I don't have a whole lot of the normal style slot entrances the normal bottom boards you'd buy. I make all my own stuff, and a lot of my high bottoms are just like boxes with corners missing, and the corner is the entrance. So staple a piece of screen over that, and then when I'm about ready to let them go, just use the hive tool to pull the staples out and let them go. Now, be aware, if you don't have a bee suit on, like, open it up and run, because they being moved around, they're probably not going to be happy. So keep that in mind. Carol Hale asks, how to decide if a first-year hive has enough brood and stores that they can be split? So it'd be the same answer to the question that I answered with Carolyn a few minutes ago. I don't want to split anything smaller than 10 frames, and it really needs to be booming at that point. If you're using queen castles where you're splitting into, you know, two or four two-frame nukes or three-frame nukes, you can do it smaller that way. More is always better. And remember that in walkaway splits, you have kind of an inefficient queen-rearing situation, because they're going to be making a lot of queens that end up getting dumped out the front door. Scott Jackson asks, what indicators do you use to inform when to make first full hive inspection of the year? Downsides of too early or too late? Full hive inspections. I want to wait for full hive inspections until the weather outside is fully warm enough so that I can open up the hive and look at things without worrying about the hive getting too cold or chilled brood or anything like that. In wintertime, I will often open the lid and shine a flashlight down in there and take a, you know, I'll be able to see how much, you guys have heard me talk about this before. I'll be able to see how much honey is capped still up in the top of the hive. And then I'll be able to see where the cluster is, so I can kind of make a gauge of how much honey they have left, how long they'll be able to survive, and how well they're doing. You know, if they're getting a start on the year in late winter, early spring, starting to expand the brood nest, that sort of thing. Downsides are too early. Too early is going to be cold. You can really mess the hive up, get it too cold and kill the brood. Any deep inspection, especially in the hive, is going to cause a lot of dysfunction for a day or so. And so you're going to lose your efficiency, maybe set your hive back more than a day. So if you're going to look deep in a hive, I would even say, you know, my typical inspection, I might not even look at the top box. I'm going to pull a box off or two boxes or whatever, get down into the cluster, pull one frame. If I see eggs on that frame, then I'm done. I don't need to know any more than that. I know the queen is laying. I know everything's going well. I can see if there's any brood disease. And from there on, just let it go. All right. Michael Cox, who is one of our moderators, he asks, getting new boxes drawn, best place to put them on the hive above or below brood, above or below drawn supers? Depends on what type of frames you're working with, whether you want them to be brood or honey. In my case, I generally put one or two new frames in the brood nest every year to be drawn out as brood frames. For honey supers, you can't do small cell in honey supers. You can't be drawn up there. It won't work. So if you want small cell or foundationless and you want to use it for brood, you're going to want to put it on the bottom or somewhere in the brood nest. If you're doing foundationless, best place to make sure you don't get cross comb and things is to put single frames, empty frames in the middle of the brood nest between two other drawn frames. That's the best way to get those drawn straight and properly. When I use plastic frames, the Manlake small cell plastic frames, I will put those, I usually just put whole boxes of them because they don't always play play with others well. So I'll put whole boxes up on top, let them be filled up with honey. They can generally be drawn out, even though they're small cell. They can generally be drawn out in the honey supers, but they're plastic, so you're going to get slower acceptance and slower drawing out. Hope that answers your question. Never a simple answer. And another one, Josh Jensen asks, oh, by the way, depending on when this is published, Josh Jensen, I think is going to be the next episode out. So look forward to talking to him. I'll actually be recording episode with him here in about half an hour after this one. So recording schedule, that's some looks on the inside of how this all works. He asks thoughts on OTS. He means male disulcones on the spot queen rearing method, which I was able to listen to Mel in person here this last March when I was in in Wisconsin, giving some talks up there. His method works, I'll tell you that. However, I don't recommend it, and here's why. His method purposefully kills queens. And to me, that reduces the impetus to develop long-lasting stock, to develop queens that live a long time, to select for queens that are very durable, that get enough sperm from the drones and lay for many years in the future. Completely by killing the queens, usually about a year old or so, you're eliminating any sort of beneficial selection that would go on in having an older queen. So that's why I don't do it. If you wanna look up his method, go ahead, check that stuff out. I think it works well. It works on the basis of introducing brood breaks into hives, which eliminates mites. But again, anything that you do in a hive is going to select for bees that need that help. All right. So if you are causing brood breaks and killing queens, then you're going to be selecting for bee populations that require you to do that. And that's in my view, a treatment. All right, I think that's the end of the patrons. Now let's get into the treatment-free beekeeping group. That's you can find on Facebook if you haven't been there. It's treatment-free. It's facebook.com/treatmentfreebeekeepers. Or if you search for treatment-free beekeepers, you'll find it there. There's another group called Reasonably Treatment-Free Beekeepers, which is a troll group, a spam group, a spoof group, whatever you want to call it. It's a group started by a guy who didn't like treatment-free beekeeping, so he made another group that's got the same name plus one word. So you can make your own judgment on that. They're not a treatment-free group. They are a group that likes to be almost treatment-free. So, well, you know, whatever. To each their own. All right, Jared Prophet asks, I'm curious to know what other people's experiences with thick-walled hives. I have regular Langstroth hives, and I've attached half-inch plywood on the outside for greater insulation. And I built a long lang out of 2x12s for the same reason. Since not everyone can have or wants to have log hives, I'm wondering if thicker, more insulated hives are better for the bees, and if so, what is the optimal R value? I believe that better insulated hives actually are better for the bees. And if you go back to listen to one of my previous episodes, it might have been with Michael Cox. I'm pretty sure it was with Michael Cox. Or maybe it was Ed English. I don't remember. I'll have to ask him. They're both moderators now, so anyway. He has polyhives, and he has had really good luck with polyhives. Our modern Langstroth hives are really well designed and suited for modern migratory beekeeping and hives that don't require going through winter. Right? Migratory beekeeping is based around a system where Bees start out somewhere in the south where a very mild winter, where they can be fed all winter and kept up in big numbers. And then they're moved to California in January and February. And then after almond pollination, they're moved up to various other places, up to Washington for apple pollination, up to the north central U.S. for clover honey, other places like blueberries and, I don't know, cranberries maybe? Anyway, so they're moved back around, and then by the time fall comes and it starts to get cold again, they're moved back down to the south, so they don't really have to go through a really harsh winter. So when you have a hive that has 3/4-inch thick walls, that's not in any way a natural environment for bees, and they're going to spend a lot of energy keeping it warm, and in the summertime when it's hot, they're going to spend a lot of energy keeping it cool. So think about that. I would say the most R value you can get is better. I'm actually moving right now, not only for insulation, but partly to a 2-inch extruded polystyrene lid. So I went down to my local Home Depot, bought some 2-inch extruded polystyrene, cut it up, made 10 lids out of one sheet, two sheets, so 20 lids. And that gives me basically $3 a lid. And then I got a soil tote. Some of you'll know what that is. It's essentially like heavy duty tarp, plastic tarp material. And it's a big bag that they put soil in, and it goes on a pallet. That's a tote. So I cut that up, made about 20 inner covers out of that. You can use feed bags. Feed bags work really well. You can also use outdoor greenhouse plastic, just something that's durable that won't immediately get ripped up by UV rays in the sun. Just put that on the hive, put the polystyrene on top of that. I happen to have some exterior covers, some outer covers with metal, so I put those on top of there just to keep the sun off of the polystyrene. If I didn't have those, I'd probably paint the polystyrene. I'll probably do some experiments, see how that works. And so for really dirt cheap, $3 per lid, and it doesn't take long to cut them up either. Just cut them up with a razor blade, score them and then break them. It's a lot easier than trying to cut a sheet of plywood into lids or trying to make some other lid style. So you get a 2-inch, that would be what, R12-ish lid for $3. I don't think you can beat that with a stick. It's pretty good. Do bees consume less honey in better insulated hives? I believe the numbers say yes. Everything that I've heard says yes, that's how that works. Better insulation, less work to maintain climate control, and so burning less honey. He says, are colonies stronger overall since they have less heating and cooling to do and better insulated hives? I've heard that also, yes. The hive will occupy more of, the colony will occupy more of the hive or all of the hive because they don't have a need to cluster as much. They may fly in lower temperatures. I think it's a great idea. The only difficulty with polystyrene hives is they're so darn expensive. You're looking at fully 2 or 3 times the cost of a wood hive. So keep that in mind. Should a quilt box be standard on all hives and not just worry hives? I don't have any experience with quilt boxes. Quilt boxes don't appear to be standard on tree hollows, so I've not made it a priority to get into that. I leave that to somebody who has more experience with it. Since we're all about efficiency here, I'm curious to know these things. Thank you for all your work and spreading the treatment-free beekeeping. Thank you for your kind words. Dave Martin says, pros and cons of externally covering hives during cold spells in winter. I imagine pros would be similar to more insulated hives. You're going to, hopefully the bees will burn less energy. A lot of the times people just use tar paper, though. Tar paper has really zero insulating value, or at least very low. It may absorb some sunlight. On a sunny day, may warm the hive up from the outside a little bit more, but some people swear by it. You know, some people say it doesn't work. It's just like bloodletting back in the day. If bloodletting didn't work for some people, they wouldn't have done it. Same thing with tar paper. Let's see. Rama Demon asks, best practices and methods for increasing stock, i.e. splits, when, how, etc. Well, this is again going to be back to your conditions. Splitting, you're going to want to work with your best hives for splitting. And the timing is again, your going to be completely based on your conditions. If you have really nice weather in spring where the bees can build up on their own and not be fed, that's the best time. I've given my full method on how I make queens and nukes in the past. I still use that same method. I used it this year. It was reasonably successful. I am working on this year a little bit of a different practice. I'm thinking maybe because we have long, wet winters and springs, I'm thinking of maybe instead of trying to sell nukes in the summertime, instead sell overwintered nukes, maybe get a premium price for a premium product. So, but yeah, you can go back and check some of my older episodes with expansion model beekeeping and some of the talks that I've given, and you can get that information. David Claypool asks, have one hive that overwintered beautifully, had strong numbers coming into spring, and queen's laying pattern was decent. However, as spring has progressed, she's laying eggs. I see larvae, but now there's no capped brood and hasn't been for about a month. I'm waiting for them to replace her, but that hasn't happened. What might be going on with them never capping the brood? Well, she's still laying up a storm, and I see larvae in jelly. I know I can replace her and save the hive for honey, etc., but I hate to lose her genetic line. She's from a bee tree swarm. I've tried splitting with her frames of eggs, and splits fail to make queen cells and cap them as well. There are no drones to speak of. I'm puzzled as I'll get out. Well, my standard answer for any beekeeping problem is let it ride. Why might this be going on? You might have a hive that has excessive hygienic behavior and is chewing out all the brood. You may have a weird hive that just doesn't cap. I don't know. It's I haven't heard of anything like that before. For me, I would let it ride, see what happens, see what kind of experiment, see what kind of result comes out of this. It could be interesting. Yeah, keep us informed. Tell us what happens there. Next question comes from Fawnwood Bowden. Pros, cons of feeding, when to feed, what to feed. I hear so many new beekeepers that keep feeding during nectar flows, etc., and are basically feeding almost constantly. Tired of hearing stuff like, they won't take it if they don't need it, etc. Well, my philosophy is based around the idea that bees are wild animals, that we are really just keeping them in boxes for our own good, not for their good. Not for their interest whatsoever. We're just keeping them in boxes for our purposes. As wild animals, they are generally expected to go out into the world and get food and bring it back here. Unless I'm messing in a hive at all, you know, I do my artificially rapid expansion and things where I'm trying to increase numbers more than naturally, I'm not going to feed at all. If there's a hive that's out on its own, it should be out on its own. They're not rabbits, right? They're not in cages. You shouldn't have to feed them. They're not going to starve to death. And if they do starve to death, it's their fault, not yours. So I totally understand. And a lot of people work on this line of thinking that they are pets, that they have to be fed all the time. And what you're getting when you do that is, first of all, bees that aren't properly nourished because they're not getting proper minerals and things from natural nectar. They're lazy. They're not going to be selected to go out and get their own nectar and make honey. And the honey that you are getting, while you may get a whole bunch of it, is basically just sugar. I mean, if I'm going to eat sugar, I'm probably going to have it in the form of ice cream or something. I don't want fake honey. I want my honey's really good because it doesn't have sugar in it. And I don't feed hives that are going to be used for honey. And I don't feed during the times when they would be trying to put that back for honey anyway. So yeah, I totally understand that. Pros and cons of feeding. Pros, that they're going to build up faster. I mean, that's the whole purpose. Cons of feeding, you're going to cause robbing. When to feed, as far as starvation goes, in the wintertime, I only feed granulated sugar if necessary, and I've talked about that many times. In the summertime, I only feed like squirms and splits, and only here. I didn't need to do that in Arkansas. You don't need to do it everywhere. It depends on your conditions. Don't do things arbitrarily. I understand. For you new beekeepers, remember, these are not pets, right? They're not cows. You don't take them to the vet. They're wild animals. They go out, they get food, they bring it back here. You know, that's how we generally use animals. You know, we can't eat flowers, so we have bees make the honey for us. You know, we can't eat grass, so we have cows and goats and things go eat the grass and then make meat and milk for us. Like, that's what's the purpose of animal-based agriculture. All right. Next question from Angie Rusty Jones. Either Rusty is a really awesome nickname, or I'm assuming Angie and Rusty have a joint account. Either way, Rusty's a good nickname. All right. What's the average transition time for those who move from chemicals to treatment-free, meaning to a self-sustaining apiary or losses equal to or less than treatments? Is there a proven method to help the bees accelerate this process? I get asked this a lot by beekeepers who treat and are wanting to move away. I try to explain the variables and bee stock sources. People seem to want Mother Nature to give them Google-level instant gratification. That's a really good point, because that's not the way the world works. We humans have been living in small agrarian communities for tens of thousands of years, and then suddenly, all this within the last 100, 200 years, technology pops up, and now in the last 20 or 30 years, the dawn of the information age, and we just don't know what the crap we're doing, because we're not evolved for this. You know, we're bungling around in the dark. And we do expect things. You know, I've got Amazon Prime as much as the next guy. I mean, I'm right now working on a computer and a soundboard and a microphone and a mouse and all the stuff that I have here on my desk. And I ordered it all from Amazon, and I got it in 2 days. Not all at once. This is all from various, I've had some of this stuff for years, but, That's the level we're at, and we have to remember that nature doesn't work that way. So that's one thing to remember. Transition time from those who move to from chemicals to treatment-free. Now, I've done this a couple of times, I consider. When I started with treated bees back in 2003, then moved to Arkansas in 2008, and in my view, when you move bees that great a distance into that different a climate, you're basically starting over. And then from there, let's see, in 2014, I moved to Colorado. And then in 2015, I moved to Oregon. So there's been a bunch of moves there. And let me just share with you some of my experience recently. I started over this last year. I moved in, 2015, October 2015, I moved the bees here. Went through winter of 2015. I lost one out of seven colonies. But that next year, 2016, those bees just did not do very well. You know, I tried to do all the normal stuff with splitting and raising queens and catching swarms and things. And they were just very lackluster, very failure to thrive. They were just surviving, right? And that's what I expected, because when you move climates like that and you don't treat and you don't feed, the bees only have their own resources to go with. And if they're totally out of whack biologically from where they are, they're not going to do very well. This year, I expected I would get a couple more out of the whole population, out of splits and natural requeening that the hives do. I would get a couple more hives. And sure enough, this year, like last year, I really had no hives that I was proud of. That's just a fact. This year, I had probably three hives when I got out to do queening, make queens and stuff. I was like, okay, I got three to choose from. Now I can really winnow down. I can really pick the best of the best. There's still only three. Next year, it'll be more like 10. All right. So every year it's going to build up as the bees get more and more acclimated to this area. So, that's why I recommend you have at least five hives. That's why I recommend you catch swarms all the time. That's why I recommend you practice increase like you want to be a commercial beekeeper one day, even though you're going to stop at 5 or 10 hives. The point is to get to a sustainable population. You don't want all of your hives to die at once because that just makes things difficult. You want a population that you can build from, even if that first or second year you don't have any performer hives. You don't make any honey. Your splits don't do very well. You're just looking for survivors at first. So I generally say 2 to 3 years before you're going to get a good, solid population of bees that do well. That's been my experience. I've done it a couple of times now. I'm doing it currently. We'll see how it goes. All right. The next question comes from Iris Vineyard. Maybe that's the name of a business. I don't know. Iris asks, what's the name of your podcast? I'm new to beekeeping and I'd like to check it out. Well, this is the Treatment Free Beekeeping Podcast, and you can find it at tfb.podbean.com. There we go. That one was easy. All right, next one. Adrian Fox. What can a small beekeeper with 2 or 3 hives actually do to encourage his colonies to be able to resist mite and disease infections? If all your stocks die out and you can just replace them with swarms from unknown provenance, then you are back at square one. As you can only propagate resistant bees from the survivors, what do you do if none of your stocks survive more than 1 or 2 years? Who are the queen breeders raising and selling resistant stock? Well, that's a good question. If all your stocks die out, then it's kind of hard to breed back from the survivors. That's very true. One of the things that I would recommend is to use small cell foundation and comb. And the reason why I use that is because I believe that by shrinking the size of the workers back to normal, I don't say shrinking them just as is, I say shrinking them back to normal or back to something that is more normal or more natural. By doing that, you can push the mite infestation more onto the drone brood, onto the drones, because the hive doesn't really need drones as much, and that will give you a better chance at survival. So using small cell comb is good. Next after that would be foundationless. And always catching swarms. If you get into the situation where you're only catching swarms every year and they're always dying, I don't know what to do there. That's not an actual situation that I have heard about, so I'm hesitant to draw conclusions based on hypotheticals. But if that's all that you can do, then keep trying, because that in itself is a successful method of beekeeping. Who are the queen breeders raising and selling resistant stock? Well, there are a few. I sell very few. I haven't sold any in the last couple of years. I'm trying to decide whether or not I'm going to sell some this next year. I'm coming to the point where all my equipment is nearly filled up and I need money for more equipment, so that would be a good time to start selling bees. We'll see what that happens. But other than that, you can find on my website at parkerbees. Sorry, Got a new website. If you go to parkerfarms.biz, it doesn't exist anymore. So, yeah, it just expired this past week, so that's not there anymore. So the new website, which has actually been up for well over a year, I think, is parkerbees.com. So that's where you can find my stuff. And on that site, parkerbees.com/map.html, you can find a Google map that I have built, which gives you sources of some treatment-free bees that are for sale, and you can get them, and you can buy them, and it's good stuff. And if you know of any sources that you'd like me to put on that map to make available to other people, please send me an email. I make no claims as to the accuracy of the information, because I just put up what's been given to me. But there are a number of suppliers there that you can get bees from. Next question. Roger Moore's James Bond. Richard Moore, I'm going to ramp up my queen rearing next spring. When you're doing yours, do you move your queen castles to separate mating yards or have them in the same yards as your other hives? I've done both, and I recommend moving them if you can, but it's not absolutely required. If you keep them in the same yard, you're going to have a lot of the bees are going to end up back in their mother hives. If you move them, you will not. So it depends on what drone fathers, what, you know, your drones, where you have your hives located and how far apart your yards are. But I would say that moving them is better. Another question from Jared Prophet. Is one type of hive objectively better than another? Langstroth, Top Bar, Sun Hive, Layens, Warray, Log Hives, etc. Or does it just come down to personal preference? What are the pros and cons of each type of hive? Wow, that's a big question. No, there is not one type of hive that is objectively better than another. It all depends on the purpose you're keeping bees for and how you want to keep bees and how much maintenance you want to do. Langstroth, as I mentioned before, is basically designed for commercial migratory beekeeping in warm locales. So that's something to keep in mind. The benefits of Langstroth is it's everywhere. It is the most common type of hive by far. Equipment's everywhere. Difficulties with it, the walls are thin. It's hard to build frames. It's not so hard to build boxes. Tops and bottoms are fairly easy. It uses all dimensional lumber, so that's easy. Top bars can be made pretty cheaply if you make them yourself. However, if you try to buy them, they're going to be pretty expensive unless you're buying them used. Sunhive, I don't have much experience with Sunhive, so don't take my word for it. I like the Layens. I've had Dr. Leo Shirashkin on the show, I think is episode 36. Go back and check that one out. Layens Hive, I think, is a really good option. Easy to build using standard materials. It's a thicker walled hive. So instead of 3/4 inch like you have with the Langstroth hive, you have an inch and a half. It's made out of 2x10s, I think. So inch and a half thickness. Warray is, I don't have any experience with those. I've talked to a few people who use them. They're the lower maintenance type of hive. The thing with Warray is there's so many different variations, so it's kind of hard to say one thing or another. Log hives, I love log hives. I don't currently have any in operation. I do have 5 of them sitting in my garage right now, drying out and waiting to be converted into actual hives. I had intended to do that this year, but I didn't get around to it, so maybe next year. They're non-maintenance type of hive generally, unless it's a horizontal hive. I'm doing vertical. I want these hives to be more decorative, to have unmanaged bees in them. So, but I have thought that you could, with the right know-how, stick a super or two on top of a log hive and get some honey off of it. I think that'd be interesting. Other types of hives. People have been talking about the Slovenian hive lately. I'm not familiar with it very much myself, but you can go check that out and see what that's all about. It really does come down to personal preference unless you have issues with overwintering and whatnot. So cold temperatures and things, you're going to want to go for a more insulated hive, I would recommend. Maybe not a tall stack hive like a Langstroth. Maybe a Lands would be better for cold climates. Top bars do require a bit more maintenance to keep comb straight. But once they're full of comb, they're generally no problem. Like I said, they're really easy to make. If you pretty much to make your own hives, a table saw would do you pretty well. I have a sliding miter saw, which is really awesome for cutting wider boards. Or even not even a table saw. You could use, if you're handy and watch your fingers, you could use a regular circular saw, cut out pieces and things. So I recommend you make as many as you can of your own. Save you a lot of money and get you deeper into the process of keeping bees. I like to get people away from the Amazon Prime experience, right? Don't just order stuff and it shows up as if by magic. Really get into it and learn the stuff. That's my recommendation. Next question by Dale Peru. I'm going to just assume it's Peru. It could be Peroux, but it's Peru. It could be Peroc. I don't know. I had a friend in college named Pontiac, and it was spelled Pontieux. So that was an odd spelling. But he was a very good guy, very hard worker, very diligent. He was a mechanical engineer, so... I haven't heard from him in a while. Hope he got a good job. I would trust him to make anything that I was driving or whatever. Anyway, Dale Peru says, observation hives, what are the best types? What are the problems? How long can you expect a colony to do well in one? Well, I would say generally you cannot expect a colony to do well in one at all for any specific period of time because to be able to see well into an observation hive, you pretty much have to split it up. You have to thin the hive so that you can get into the heart of the brood nest, which is not beneficial to the bees. They're going to have trouble keeping temperature and humidity. And the thicker you make the hive, the more frames you put side by side, the less you're going to be able to see the queen. And it's kind of defeats the whole point. So... an observation hive, I would say, is a good thing to learn the process, to teach others how bees work, to observe what's going on. But long term, I would not try. Well, try. I would not count on them to do well long term. Michael Bush said that an observation hive. And I could be misquoting here, but something to the effect of the observation hive basically is a good way to view how hives collapse. So that's it's. I mean, hives are not forever things. So I've been planning on getting one of those ones that has one frame up top, a portable one, and then like five frames down below. And so you put the queen up top and then it's a temporary thing. You take the stuff out and take it to show people, and then you bring it back and you put it back in a hive. So I think one of those were good. The idea of having an observation hive in a house it seems fun and I'm sure it would be awesome to look at, but ultimately, it's probably going to die. Maria Williams, she wants to know, I'm assuming it's a she, overwintering nukes, how much food, what does a five-frame nuke look like for overwintering, honey in the frames in the bottom box, or do you put another box on top with frames of honey? Personally, I have not yet overwintered nukes. I may be going to try it this year, but I have not. I have read Michael Palmer's materials. You can find him around the internet on YouTube, and he's got some videos on Vimeo or somewhere else, I think. Check out his stuff. Kirk Webster is another really good overwintering nuke guy. You can find his stuff at kirkwebster.com, I believe. So yeah. So instead of listening to me bloviate about things that I've never done, which I try not to do, Go check out those really good resources. Dave Martin asks, the importance of being stung is really interesting. Yes, it is. I think it is important to be stung. Not only for the fact that being stung is good for you, it is good for regulating your immune system and reducing inflammation. It's also been told, I've been told that you can reduce scar tissue if you sting scars with it, sting scars with bees. And especially in normal practice, as you all know, I don't use gloves when I keep bees, when I manipulate hives and things. So what that does for me is it, first of all, it gives me a good solid source of stings. So I get stung a couple hundred times a year. And getting stung is really not that bad. I mean, you get 20 or 30 seconds of kind of burning pain and then it goes away and you get along with your life. And if you get stung you don't even swell up. My son was swimming in one of his friend's pools the other day and he got stung on his finger and his whole finger swelled up to the point where he could hardly bend it. I can get a full sting. I can get multiple stings. In fact, I was doing a test a few months back on, I have a scar on my left forefinger and I stung it 5 times with full stings. Like I stuck the stinger in there and let it stay in there for like an hour. Like it was got the full load of venom. And, I barely had any swelling. I had a little bit of soreness, but 5 full stings in one spot. And you know, when you get stung often enough, it really doesn't bother you that much. But it also teaches me how to manipulate a hive carefully and gently and quickly, get the job done without upsetting the bees. You know, what I do when I go out to work bees is the first thing I do is I light a smoker and I set it somewhere, and half the time I don't even use it. I'm in there with no gloves, working bees pretty quickly, like I'm not slow. But I'm gentle and I'm deliberate and I rarely get stung and I rarely get a hive mad at me. So it's a really good way to learn how to keep bees. And the next question comes from Ben Sierra Flinders. I'm guessing that's another joint account. I don't know. Sierra's kind of a pretty name for a dude named Ben. Or maybe, I don't know. Anyway, having fun. A lot of beekeepers are told to watch for visual signs in the exterior of the hive that signal what is happening inside the hive, but aren't being told what those things are. So what are they? What are they looking for? And what do they mean? Well, this is a pretty difficult question to answer because I can't exactly tell you what I'm seeing when I'm looking at a hive. So one of the fun things that happens in our brains is that we have a whole level of understanding that we can approach the world with, which is nonverbal. And by explaining it, by putting words to experiences and things that we observe, we actually change our memory of the experience. So I can't tell you exactly what to look for. I can tell you some, but a lot of my experience at looking at hives and being able to tell how they're doing comes from just looking at them and just, you know, having 14 years of experience, just looking and knowing, having these connections and models built in my brain, that are not easy to tell. But some of the things you can look for is, how are the bees coming and going from the entrance? Robbers, for instance, will buzz around the entrance because they are smelling. They're finding by smell how to get into the hive. Normally, in a hive it's going everything a-okay, you'll see the workers, they'll fly in and they'll almost land directly in the entrance. Unless the entrance is small and they know they have to land somewhere else and then walk in, that's also an option. But in our big Langstroth hives, they generally will fly almost directly into the entrance. And so the idea of a landing board, therefore, is itself kind of superfluous. But a good hive is going to have workers coming and going. They're going to be landing in the entrance. They're not going to be buzzing around. On the other hand, if you're looking at the hive in the evening, early evening, early to mid-evening, not late evening, early to mid-evening is when you'll have the time when new foragers are taking their first flights outside the hive, and they will buzz around in circles. And you'll see them orienting themselves because the hive entrance is located spatially in a bee's brain, right? It's not like a flat map. It's a three-dimensional point in space that they know they have to get to. And you can see this when you move hives or change entrance sizes or something. If you have a small entrance and you go to a bigger entrance, you know, say later in the summer you want more ventilation, you will see the bees all landing in the same little entrance space that they had before. Or if you change entrance locations, if you have an upper entrance and you put a bunch of boxes on the hive and now the hive is like two boxes taller, you'll see a lot of workers going back to the crack where the top entrance was between where it's now between the boxes. So that's something you can look for. Another thing, hives being active when they should be active. If other hives in the yard are active and one hive is not active, there's maybe something going on there. Maybe there's has been a brood break due to a queen supersedure or something like that. And there's a dearth of foragers. And so there may be already a good population of bees from the new queen in the hive, but there are not a lot of them are foragers. What else can you look at from outside the hive? I'm trying to think. Like I said, this is something that takes a lot of practice. And it's not something that you just, that you learn. It's something that kind of comes to you over time as you experience, as you gain experience working on bees, working with bees. One of the things you can do, which a lot of people already do, which is great, is to get yourself a lawn chair and just go sit in front of a hive and watch them. And you may not be learning anything directly in that sense, but your brain is going to be working on stuff that you are not realizing. Your brain is going to be building models in your head that are going to serve you well later on. So I guess that's my answer to that. I'm sorry I can't give you more direct things like that. Malcolm Gladwell wrote a really good book called Blink that talks about how your snap judgment works in your brain and how your brain can process things on a level beneath your conscious level. And so that level of your brain is trained throughout your life. And by gaining more experience with bees, that level of your brain is going to be programming itself. And so you'll come along to a hive and you'll see that something's wrong without even knowing what's wrong or why it's wrong. Or you'll look at a hive and you'll see that it's perfectly fine without even knowing why. And so when you embrace that skill, you'll find yourself inspecting your hives a lot less regularly because you don't need to. It's not that vital. So another fun brain science thing, one of my hobbies. Next question, Alec Meyer. Observation hives. Didn't I already do one? Yes, I did. I did a question on observation hives, Alec, from Dave Peru. So go back and listen to that. Your question specifically was what kinds, how many frames are for overwintering, trick tips, etc. Like I mentioned before, observation hive is not going to be a good healthy way to keep bees. So good to look at, good for experiments and observation, but generally stick to normal hives, I guess. Gayla Coy Kendall, Is that maybe like a Scottish name? I don't know. It's an interesting name. What is the optimal amount of ventilation for 100 degree days? This is going to be, again, one of those things that's going to be totally your to your area. Here, like I have hives out now with fairly small entrances. They're small hives. They're nukes or growing nukes that have fairly small entrances, maybe an inch by 3/4 inch hole in 100 degree days. And they're not having any problems. What you will see, especially in more humid areas, like when I was in Arkansas, I saw a lot of bearding. So it seemed almost from April to September, at least, there would always be bees hanging out in front of the hive, no matter how much ventilation I gave them. And there will come to a point where you'll get too much ventilation and it will throw off their thermoregulation of the brood nest. It does help with processing nectar into honey, because, you know, when nectar comes into a hive, it's 80% water, 20% sugar. And when honey is cured, it is less than 20% water and more than 80% sugar. So all that water has to go somewhere. So that's what the ventilation is for. However, bees are excellent ventilators. They know what they're doing. They know how to do it. As long as the entrance is big enough, they will handle business. If it's too small, they can have trouble getting air in and out. But I forget where I read it, but somebody was recounting about how they had connected an observation hive to the outside with a 1-inch plastic tube. And they were observing that in that 1-inch diameter plastic tube, the bees had fully two-directional air circulation through that one little tube. So bees can do it. They really can handle ventilation. So I can't really tell you what the optimal amount is. They're the ones that control that. In fact, I was just bringing in one of my hives, a dead out that I had that overwintered. And it had an 1.25-inch diameter hole for the entrance in the front of the hive. And they had used propolis to block off probably 4/5 of that hole. So they don't need as much ventilation as we think they need. Linda Petty Van Scoter says, I would love to hear an episode teaching step-by-step instructions on how to maintain a hive your first few months, plus the do's and don'ts. It is so scary starting out knowing minimal information. That is very true. It can be pretty scary starting out. Beekeeping tends to be one of those things that is more attractive to more adventurous people, and that's just the nature of the thing. But yeah, it would be good to have an episode. Let me write a note down, and I will maybe work on that. I will tell you this. I do have my expansion model beekeeping page, or no, my queen rearing page. One of the pages on my website, I have kind of like a first year model of expansion model beekeeping and the things that you should do to do your best to expand your numbers, especially going in for your first winter. But yeah, step-by-step instructions on maintaining your hives for the first few months. A couple of tips I would give is don't inspect too often. Now, if you're working with foundationless methods, top bars, Langstroth foundationless, other things like that, you're going to want to get in there, you know, once a week or so, just to make sure the comb is not getting cross-combed and maybe, you know, straighten things up a little bit. But if you have an established hive, I mean, really, an inspection doesn't involve more than opening the hive, pulling out a frame of the center of the brood nest, seeing eggs, and then putting it back. To me, there doesn't need to be done more than that. And a lot of first-year beekeepers will end up over-inspecting their hives and actually causing them harm by that. So I recommend against that sort of thing. That's one of my biggest pieces of advice for new beekeepers. Pat Noonan asks, or says, I'm interested in the concept of temperature and humidity and how it affects both the problem of mites and the curing of honey. I don't know of any direct evidence that shows that it has an effect on mites. I'm sure that because mites are cold-blooded, as are bees, that temperature will have some effect on gestation time and post-capping times and things like that. But I don't think I'm the guy to tell you exactly what that is, how that works at this time. Gotta admit, when I don't know, I'm that kind of guy. But as far as curing honey, as I mentioned just a minute ago, you know, honey comes in, or nectar comes in with a lot of water, and it goes out with a little water, and that all that water has to go somewhere, and it goes out through the air. A couple of fun facts with humidity. A lot of people don't understand relative humidity, so I'm looking at my little weather station on my desk right here, and it says 87 degrees outside with 37% humidity. Now, as the temperature goes up, the ability of air to hold water becomes greater. So if the actual amount of water floating around in the air does not change, as the temperature goes up, the humidity will go down, and vice versa. That's an important thing to remember. Another thing that's interesting, the common knowledge is that heat rises. That's not technically correct. Heated fluids rise relative to non-heated fluids. That's the more technical version. So if you have some hot air, air is a fluid, you are in a room that's got non-hot air, it's like a helium balloon. That heated air is going to rise because it is less dense than the rest of the air in the area. Now, if you mix water, as in with a beehive, if you mix water into that air, you put humidity into the air, the density of water vapor is lower than the density of air. So moist air will actually drop. Okay. Now there's a confluence between the temperature, how much it's heated, and the actual buoyancy of the air mixture. So sometimes it'll drop, sometimes it'll rise, depending on the temperatures in the area. But again, remember that bees are expert ventilators. That's one of the main jobs they do, and so they can handle that. So there's some fun facts, some things that I've come across. As far as the curing of honey, that's an interesting thing that I observed back in Arkansas. If I had five-frame nukes, my five-frame nukes have inch and a quarter diameter round entrances. In the springtime, when it was really moist, you know, just starting to get warmed up, a lot of rain still going on, I would have sometimes the nectar in the combs would ferment. And so I would go out to the bee yard, and here's one of those things that you can identify from outside the hive. I could smell fermentation, right? Smells like alcohol or, you know, wine, or, you know, those of you that are homebrewers know what that smells like. Rotten juice. I mean, not rotten, but fermenting juice. Those of you that are familiar with fermentation, you know what that smell is. So I smelled that around my hives, and I looked in these five-frame nukes, and the honey was fermenting in the comb, and you can identify that, or not honey, nectar, uncured nectar was fermenting in the combs, and so you can identify that by looking in the comb and see little bubbles in the cells, right? The bees cleared it up, they dealt with it, but that becomes an extra thing that they have to deal with, so that hive would need more ventilation. Now, there's no way to provide more ventilation with those five-frame nukes because the entrances aren't adjustable, so they just had to live with it. But anyway, that's some fun stuff. Jared Prophet again asks, how about a segment on what traits to look for when you do your splitting and grafting? We all know we want to split from strong hives, but a broader definition of what that means might help folks when deciding what to expand from each spring. Good question. As I've said many, many times, what I'm looking for in bees are, first of all, survivors, which if they're dead, you know, that kind of chooses that for you. Secondly, I want them to be gentle. And third, I want them to be productive. So when I see hives during the productive time of the season doing productive work and getting a lot of work done and bringing a lot of honey, those are the hives that I'm going to go after. The other details, how they get that done, is of much less concern to me. So I have some hives that have lots of really sticky propolis, which I'm not a huge fan of. And I have other hives that have not very much propolis and more hard, what would be a good word for it? Not crusty, but brittle, that's a good word. Hard, brittle propolis, and that's what I'd rather have. But, you know, that's a totally secondary thing. If I'm deciding against between two hives, and one hive's got lots of nasty, sticky propolis, and one has much less, more brittle propolis, I'm probably going to go with the less, all things being equal, just because I like that more. You can find a page on my website. I forget what the actual name of it was, but I got this list of traits that you can look for from somebody I talked to online, a beekeeper from Alabama, I think it was. I think his name on BeeSource was Fusion Power. Anyway, I cite the whole thing, you know, who it's from, because it's not original to me. But that's a good list of things you can go through to see what are the sorts of traits that you're looking for. But again, I don't want to do too much specific trait breeding, because I think the most important thing is that the bees survive and are productive and are gentle. And I don't want to be too persnickety, too hands-on. As a manager, I'm a trial by fire sort of guy. I like to let people jump in and figure out how to do it themselves. And my only concern is what the finished product is. If you can do the finished product under cost and under time, and, you know, then I don't care how you pull it off. I mean, let's not do anything illegal, but, you know, I'm not one of those people that expects you to be on time every morning and expects you to do all the stuff and all the things. I want the job done right. Like, that's the most important thing to me. Get the job done right. So that's the way I work with bees as well. It's their job to figure out how to do it. I don't want to be messing around with too many things to make their job harder. So I want them to develop the traits that they need to get it done properly. Another question from Jared. Something else I notice with new beaks, and I've been guilty of this in the past, is indecisiveness when it comes to actually performing management in the hive, a fear of disturbing things, and being too trusting that the bees, especially first-year nukes and packages, will be able to figure everything out with no intervention whatsoever, rather than taking steps to give that hive a better chance at making it through the first winter. So I suppose my question would be what should new, especially first-year beekeepers, be looking for, and what management should be done to ensure stronger colonies going into that first winter? First, I would say stay away from buying bees. Start with swarms if at all possible. When you put money into things, you become invested, and when you lose your investment, you get angry. You get afraid. When you're afraid of losing your investment, you have fear and then anger, and then, you know, that's the dark side. I gotta go back and rememorize that joke. It's a good joke. But I forget the order. Anger leads to the dark side. So don't buy bees. Other things to do. Really, I'm a believer that too much management is a bad thing, as I mentioned earlier. But also don't be afraid. Even if you just get your suit on and open the hive and take out a couple frames and look at them, just look and learn. If you're going to be afraid, just call up somebody and give the hive away, because it's, fear is not something that I make a part of my life, and I don't think you should either. So don't be afraid. That's number one. Don't be afraid of getting stung. You know, if you have to, go out and grab a bee and sting yourself. Like, learn what it's about. There's no reason to be afraid of bees. I realize that many humans have natural inbuilt phobias of swarming insects, and I understand that. If you've got a particularly heavy phobia like that, maybe you shouldn't be a beekeeper, or maybe you should decide that you're going to overcome it. But if you're gonna spend money on hives and hopefully not, but also bees, like, it's your money. You can make it worth it for yourself or not. I can't do it for you. I can tell you what to do. I can't make you do it. That's just part of life. What should beaks be looking for? I don't know. What should you be looking for? You should be looking. You should be observing and learning. You should have more than one hive so you can compare and contrast. And if one hive goes queenless, you can add brood. If a hive is not doing well, you can add honey. You can boost things. But keep your eyes open. Don't be afraid. Jump in. The worst thing that's going to happen is that you're going to kill thousands of insects, which, if you've driven anywhere, you do that all the time. I mean, that's, don't be too precious about it. I was speaking of being precious about bees. I prefer not to kill bees. Like, I'll say that out front. A lot of people like avoid killing bees if at all possible. And I understand that. But, you know, this is in a sense farming. This is agriculture. I was giving a swarm away last night, and I was stapling some screen over the entrances and discovered that there was a hole in the bottom board, and so there were bees getting out everywhere. And so it's a big old mess, and I was trying to staple screen all over the place. And, you know, once you get the thing stapled up and you're shipping the thing out and bees are still attacking you, I mean, you just got to handle business. And so I had to smash a few bees, and I got stung plenty of times, and that's just part of life. You know, they get mad sometimes, and that's how you deal with it. I know some of you are like cringing right now thinking, Solomon smashes bees. I also drive into swarms sometimes on the road because they're in the way. And when you're going 75 miles an hour, you can't really swerve. So, you know, whatever. It's life. Everything dies. We die. They die. Sorry to bum you out. John Bell asks, slatted rats in the... slatted racks in the bottom. If you've got slatted rats in your hives, I don't know what to tell you. That's your problem. Send me an email. We'll talk about it. But I don't have any answers for slatted rats. Slatted racks in the bottom, good, bad, or ugly? I've heard they're good. I've never tried them. It's one of those things that's like an extra thing that I, you know, extra things are work and money, and I'm efficient. You might say lazy, but efficient. I'm efficient, and I don't have a lot of money, so I leave out a lot of things that aren't necessary. Most things that aren't necessary, I try to leave out. And there's a page on my website, too, about leaving out things that aren't necessary, things not to do. So if you want to try slatted racks, that's good. What slatted racks are, you can Google this and you can see what they look like. They are a conglomeration of boards which run parallel to the bottoms or tops of the frames, and they separate the frames from the entrances. I think probably slatted racks wouldn't be necessary if we didn't have such large entrances in these hives. And by necessary, I mean desirable. So yeah, I've never tried them. If you want to try them, go ahead. I mean, I might try them one day. I try new things every year. I specifically, decide a couple of new things that I'm going to try every year. And that's part of my continuing education process in beekeeping. So that's the end of the show. So I'm going to have a little audio filler thing, and then I'm going to come back with the credits. Thanks again, everybody, for making it all the way through another episode of the Treatment Free Beekeeping Podcast. The show is produced, edited, and engineered by me. My executive producer is Adam Blitz, and this show is brought to you by him and the other patrons at patreon.com/TFB. If you want to support the show, you can become a patron too, and also get access to the new TFB Pub on Facebook. Music is by Jeb Botiford. If you want a jingle for your project, you can find him on Twitter at Jeb Botiford. And if you can find me on Twitter, you can follow me, but I don't post bee stuff there. So good luck, because it's an anonymous account. Anyway, the Facebook group is at facebook.com/treatmentfreebeekeepers. Facebook group admins are Tony Holmes, Scott Offord, and Michael Cox. Moderators are Jason Bruns, Adam Blitz, Ed English, Chris Andrews, and Mike Mahar. You can find Treatment Free Beekeeping videos at youtube.com/treatmentfreebeekeeping. The Treatment Free Beekeeping forum is at forum.tfbees.net, and the admins there are Dusty Monkey and Michael Bush. My website's parkerbees.com, and my rarely updated blog is at parkerbees.blogspot.com. Thanks for joining me again. I'm Solomon. Have fun keeping bees, because if you're not having fun, maybe you could buy a tent and go camping instead.